Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric 13. I am joined today by Michael Kester.
Hello.
Who?
Little Man America. Tell us that's about. Me. I'm Little Man America.
Need you to tell me about spoilers, Patreons, chapters, and all of that.
So we'll start with chapters. Moving on to the Patreon. It's patreon.com/
What's a chapter?
Double feature.
What are you doing?
What? I gave you all you needed to know about chapters.
Okay.
On the Patreon, you can go on there. You can pick films. Welcome to Double Feature Year 12. Put your movies on the show this year.
We do need some movies on the show this year.
I know. We just tried to pick literally two shows, and it took an hour and a half.
Yeah, but it was a blast.
It was really fun. But it was
maybe the best hour of my week so far was just trying to figure out movies with you and then finding some random nonsense from the 80s and trying desperately. It's like candy.
I know.
It's like we came up with a double feature. It'll come up in a couple weeks. And we know the right two movies to do, but neither one is this fucking nonsense I'm looking at from the 80s. And we both knew the right thing to do. We wanted to put the nonsense movie in anyways. And honestly, I feel like most of the time was not spent finding pairs. It was spent talking ourselves out of doing the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm.
That was really most of it. And you can find that episode in the future. That doesn't help us plug the Patreon. Where was I going with this? Anyways, the Patreon, patreon.com/double feature. You are correct. It's how we fund the show. It's how people get movies on the show. If you're new to Double Feature, just a few episodes ago, we began the year with Blade Runner and Fargo. We began anew. You don't need any of that old nonsense before that. Just go
fresh
back.
Start. No old jokes.
Go back to that, and you've only got a couple episodes to catch up on. This is a show that is really so much better if you have seen the movies in advance of listening. Part of that is because we spoil the movies.
That's true.
I was hoping you'd get to the spoilers.
Sorry, you cut me off by having way more to say about the Patreon than me. Shocker. You always have way more to say about the Patreon than me. I'm always like, it's hard to pick movies.
Somebody's balancing the budget over here. sweating it out at the end of every month.
Yeah, we're going to spoil these movies. Which movies, you ask? Why, we're going to spoil Ratatouille and Big Man Japan, I answer.
In that order or the other order? What's better here?
I honestly think the other order is better, but we got all them Ratatouille movies to get to.
No, stop. Stop it. Other things you do to derail the show, send me Key and Peele sketches before we do the fucking show.
I'll let you pick, because I think there's a conversation for either one, but I think that if we front load with
fuck it. Let's do Ratatouille first.
Perfect.
Let's do Ratatouille first. Right. Like, people have seen Ratatouille. They don't know what the fuck Big Man Japan is.
We'll do it in order of most to least animation, which Big Man Japan does for you. But
that's good. Yeah. I like when the double features, just the thread spirals into it. Just what's that word where you pull a thread and the sweater phrase? That's what I want.
Right.
The sweater, that phrase into
the Weezer song.
Mm-hmm. No. Let me put you on defense immediately, because I need to ask you a very personal, intimate question.
All right.
Why have you been dying to watch Ratatouille so fucking much?
I have read an article.
Uh-huh.
Are we on Ratatouille? Is this Ratatouille?
There's a thing that's been going on where Michael is just constantly trying to do Ratatouille. And so I know somewhere in your own life, you don't know if Ratatouille, you're not yet aware that Ratatouille is the best Pixar film. You don't have this information.
Definitely true.
So yeah, throwing that out there right now.
That's not a thing I knew. No.
So you're kind of going, well, I could just watch Ratatouille, but what if it's not the best Pixar film? That'll have been a waste of time.
Well, what
therefore,
if it is?
I must
that will
put
also
it on
be
the show.
A waste of time, because then I have to watch it again. Come on. You know how this goes.
Uh-huh.
I read an article that claimed, it was by a reputable source, a source so reputable I've forgotten it. And it claimed that it was something, the headline. So most people, you read these articles online and they're your fucking standard clickbait. They're like, you won't believe who donated billions of dollars to rebuild Notre Dame, or, you know, the old school classic clickbait, like 13 reasons that your dad hates your mom. Number five is too true.
Listicle.
For me, a standard clickbait article goes something to the effect of an essay as to why Ratatouille is the only perfect movie ever made.
Oh, good. Good.
And I go, I'm interested.
Yeah.
But
I follow so far.
I can't read that article because I'm missing.
So we're just working through your internet bookmarks.
That's well, there's what we're doing. One, there's a, you know, that's the thing is you see that article and you go, I could read this whole article and I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. It's almost like if you came to a podcast that was about just two movies, not every movie ever made, just two of them, and you opted not to watch them and then listen to us talk about them.
I, you know, it's funny because I claim that Ratatouille as a hugely commercially successful movie by a giant Goliath is the movie people have seen, and this crazy Big Man Japan movie is what no one have seen. For the people who listen to the show, the opposite is probably true.
It's definitely right? true for me.
They're probably going, of course I love Big Man Japan, but that rat movie with the like talking chef rat, I don't know what that is. I haven't seen that, and I'm here to tell you that you should fucking watch it because it's glorious.
I think the thing today that really amuses me about these two movies is that Ratatouille, I can say for sure this is the case, and Big Man Japan, I can only assume is the case. If I were to sit down with you and go, Big Man Japan is a movie about this guy who gets big to defend Japan from monsters, you'd go, okay, I think I know how that movie plays out. And you'd be pretty close to right.
But where I'd be wrong is surprising.
Where you'd be wrong is surprising. Number 24 minutes will shock you. But I think Ratatouille is even more in that vein because I knew what Ratatouille was about. Listen, I'm not completely under a rock. Game of Thrones is over. I've emerged from the rock.
Uh-huh.
And
we call that a bunker here on Double Feature, but yeah.
And you told me, you know, Ratatouille is about this guy who's got a Ratatouille in his hat. And
it's close. That's not his name, but it's fine.
And he, you know, it's like this guy who's like a bad chef and this rat who's a good chef and then movie. Well, let me tell you, that is exactly what Ratatouille is about. And it plays out exactly the way you'd expect it to. And there are zero surprises, except that it's really fucking good anyway. And it's almost like it goes, listen, we have a really basic premise. We're just going to stick to this and nail every beat of the story.
Well, you know what's surprising to me about
that? Nothing about this movie surprised me.
Yeah, I think, you know, I've thought a lot about that too, especially watching it this time. And, you know, we're kind of, I look at it a little bit different because we're going to do it on Double Feature. So I'm kind of going, what do we talk about? Like, what's the most important use of our time on this? And the thing that really caught up with me about the writing, you know, in some ways it's just so smart because when you really work an idea to the point where you have these waves, you ride this emotional roller coaster, right? Things are going very well. And then all of a sudden there's just a little bit of a wrinkle and things start going very badly. You know, the kid can't cook. And then by some happy accident and a newfound friendship, he kind of fails upwards, right? The movie mm-hmm. talks about that a little bit. And he finds himself in a position where he's gotten the chance and can maximize it through this newfound friendship. Things start going really well. But then you know the rat's hungry and he's going to, at some point, you just know it, he's going to sneak in there with his friends and family and steal the food even though he shouldn't. And the movie's telling you that's going to happen. And then things are going to go very badly and they're going to have to come back from that. And it's the ebbs and flows, whether you really want to get into it by act to act when that happens and where is the midpoint, or you just want to make it as simple as we're going up and then something's going to happen and we're going to go down fast and we've got to recover. The thing about that, that is just such a, you know, the movie has such a formulaic perfection to it, but at the same time, I think you get so caught up in it that it still catches you off guard. It does for me. I mean, I know those things. They're signposted. I know they're coming a mile away. And I also have seen the fucking movie before. But I just get so wrapped up in the exchange of the characters and the little moments of what it's doing that I forget that it's almost time for things to get really bad again.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they get bad, I get so worried about the state of affairs that I forget that everything's going to fucking be okay, because that's just how the movies go. And so, I don't know, I guess watching it this time, I was really kind of delighted by how you can have formulaic perfection, and that doesn't mean that it makes the movie stale. In fact, quite the opposite somehow.
Right.
That maybe if you're just doing everything else really well, it doesn't even matter that you're, like you said, that you're moving along, you know, this path that we pretty much know the outline of.
Yeah, I mean, there are the moments for me that really... So there's two things that you just made me think of in what you were saying. One is sort of the moment that made me panic, which is when the health inspector comes in. Yeah. That moment makes me panic more than any other moment in the movie. But there's a weird thing, and I want to come back to it, that has to do with the... can't think of his name, but the chef.
Linguini?
Chef number two.
Yeah.
So
chef number two being the main character.
Yeah. So we'll come back to him.
The other thing
that this movie I thought was billboarding that it never came back to was the stars on the restaurant, because it went down to a 3-star restaurant out of a 5-star restaurant. And I thought for sure we were going to go back up to a 5-star restaurant, but that never came to fruition.
Kind of a nice little twist in it though, right? The ending.
Definitely. It's definitely one of those endings, and maybe this is a good backwards way to come around to it. One of the things that this movie does that I think is really interesting and has become super prevalent in today's reboot culture with films. So just to rehash, we are in a place in society now where a film will come out, say Candyman, and it is announced that it is not going to replace the original film. It will certainly replace every sequel to the original film, because always, for some reason, fuck those. But it will not replace the original film. It will be a successor to the original film while rebooting the spirit of the original story. But they're gonna respectfully not trample the original film's audience, so you're not allowed to get mad that it's a remake. But also, they're definitely actually remaking it, and new audiences will not have had to see the original Tony Todd film.
Okay, only on Double Feature do we make the segment about Ratatouille secretly about Candyman. What are you getting at?
Listen,
here?
Listen, I'm getting at this thing that I feel like Ratatouille is probably the earliest movie that I've seen this happen with, where it goes, it's not the best thing, but it's pretty close to the best thing, and we're all happy with this, right?
I fail to see what that has to do with Candyman, but yes, in the spirit of moving on, let's jump ahead. I see what you're saying.
Where it's kind of this moment where it goes, and he didn't actually get to save the restaurant, which was, you know, his whole goal, but now he has his own restaurant, and in a way, that's a lot better. And I'm like, it's not, but I guess he's happy. You know, it's that question of, if the individual character finds the most happiness in this scenario, am I, as an audience member, wrong?
Yeah. Yeah.
Which brings me back to the thing about Linguini, which is that I never like this guy. And so the pursuit of his happiness for me is never a motivator for the movie. I'm 100% on board with Remy.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm 100% on board with a lot of these other characters. I mean, he just seems like an avatar to something, but I don't connect to his desires.
I thought that's why we were doing this with Big Man Japan, because it's such a, like, you know, Big Man Japan won't end up completely being about avatars. In fact, it's not even the kaiju adjacent film that I would, of course, cite for that.
Right.
But Ratatouille totally is.
Right.
Ratatouille is more of that traditional kaiju avatar thing than Big Man Japan is.
And so when you get to the end of the movie, I'm just like, well, as long as Remy's happy, that's where I end up.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few key reasons that it's my favorite of the Pixar films. And the plot thing impresses me. And, you know, Remy as a character, I like a lot. But I think, again, these are things we discovered with our Disney journey. last year on the show, where we looked at a lot of the Disney animated films. Like, of course, they're good at these things. But there is, I mean, one, like, roll your eyes at me. It's French, and you know that's the easiest way to win me over right now. And so we're in Paris, so I'm excited. Mm-hmm. I'm just happy to be here. That's a very simple thing. It's also got this working team of scoundrels, of pirates that they point out
right
in this kitchen, and the camaraderie there. And I think that's reminds me of being a technician in Chicago. You know, it just hit some like nostalgic nerve in my
right
in my head somewhere. These people who work,
Chicago being the Paris of America.
Yeah, right, right. America's Paris. Just the idea of a team working behind closed doors, spending all day with each other in maybe what could be, it's both a nurturing but a tense environment, and getting to know each other that way. And I like exploring the characters through that. But I think the character Colette in this movie,
mm-hmm.
the character that Jeanine Garofalo voices, this is one that stood up especially today. And I had an even bigger appreciation for than I did before. I mean, it's one of my favorite characters from any of these movies. Very human character. But also, this was a character that was a representation of feminism before 2019, when everyone's taking their kind of crude stab at that.
Mm-hmm.
Their kind of, or what they think it is. You know, this is a character who's refined, has some details to her. It's more than just the blunt battle cry stand-in that's kind of become something we see over and over today. And I like that, you know, it's still, look, it's still a cartoon. It's still, she's very clearly drawn. You know what her motivations are. She shouts them at the main character. But that just makes it easy to understand, I think. It's somebody who's dynamic. It's a character that we know why she is the way she is. And she puts up this hard exterior about her, that she's somebody who, another archetype I love, just on top of themselves in their job, you know, very technically proficient, had to be that way to overcome these walls that have been put up. And then we also get to see this soft side of her once she's let a person into her life,
mm-hmm.
right? Once she knows that Linguini's not out to get her or sabotage her in some way or hit these nerves that she has, we also get to see this human value in the character shepherding someone else along. And that's something that I appreciate the writing aspect of that a lot. I appreciate what they do with that character. There's a lot of nice little moments in the surprises of the film. We kind of talked about the surprise of closing the restaurant and the ending and all that, but even just the little moments of like that pepper spray mm-hmm. scene she has. I mean, just thinking about the surprises of the movie, there's a lot of those little bits that are cool too. There's that payoff shot of tasting the ratatouille.
Yeah.
On a totally different subject, yeah. right? Where it's just, it transports the critic instantly, shockingly, back to his childhood. These are just little character moments that I like, that you build people up to be one way and you reveal these other things about them, which is something that when we talk about a cartoon representation, isn't something we get a lot.
Sure.
That's the very opposite. So now we have in this critic, this other character, we have this guy who has told you he is the villain of the film, mm-hmm. the villain of the story.
The villain of food.
Totally, totally.
Yeah.
And we don't spend a lot of time with him, but when we sit down with him and taste the soup, we realize he had this whole other story we didn't explore.
Sure.
And we've melted through his jaded kind of critic heart, taken him back to his own childhood. It's just so perfectly written and delivered. The vision of it is just very cool.
His monologue / review at the end of the movie is probably my favorite thing in the whole movie, being somebody who doesn't review movies but watches a lot of them,
yeah.
is is his whole, as far as like a revelation of his persona, that to me is stronger than even him being, you know, Back to the Future by the Ratatouille.
What's amazing, it's like we skipped all of the parts we usually get building up to that moment.
Sure.
But I think the moment itself just tells us all of that.
Sure.
We get everything we need out of that.
Yeah. And he just,
really cool.
I love that. I love that voiceover review. The first few lines where he says, first of all, I love that he's out the gate. Like, being a critic is easy. All you do is say things suck when you don't like them. And it's easy.
And doesn't shame the audience for that.
Right.
Also goes in as readers. It's kind of fun. We have fun with it. Mm-hmm. It's entertaining, whatever.
And then he goes, but the hardest thing about being a critic is admitting when something is like, when you were wrong or when something surprises you. And that brings me to Hellboy. No, I'm not going to get on that subject. But yeah, I think that character, it's really interesting, especially coming from a Pixar place, because the villainy of Pixar is probably something journey worthy. Don't worry, that's not a tease for year 12. But I think that there's a conversation about the villainy of Pixar movies, which is that oftentimes even the manifestation of the bad thing in a Pixar movie is actually just sort of the hammer being swung by the protagonist.
How do you mean?
Well, I mean, like in this movie, you have a character who's not really, in essence, he's not the bad guy. He's a food critic, and this film just decided to be about a restaurant. But he's not evil. He's not malicious. He's, you know, he doesn't have very good soft skills, but he's not, you know, he's not Ursula from The Little Mermaid.
God, I actually think that he's totally fucking right. I mean, he's basically the most evil thing he does. Maybe somebody can fucking fact check me on this, but in my mind,
don't worry, there's an article somewhere that I'm about to read that probably does it for you.
I know. I feel like the meanest thing he does is compare it to Chef Boyardee.
Right.
But then we see that, you know, the actual kind of villain of the movie is the original chef.
Right.
I guess not the original chef, the chef that takes over.
Yeah, right.
So he's kind of selling out the restaurant, and it takes away, what was the word they used? It was just such the dignity, right? A perfect word. The dignity of the restaurant. Linguini wants to come in, restore some of the dignity a little bit, whereas the other chef is just paying lip service to that. And so what does the critic do? He calls out basically the absence of dignity, that it's just become this commercial franchise. You know, even the very things that it represented have fallen by the wayside. I think the most evil thing, honestly, about him is just the way they paint him like a villain.
Sure. He looks like a bad guy. He just looks like a bad guy.
The lights are always shadowy around him. You know, he has this, his body is just physically fucking shaped like the villain, and that's it.
Speaking of being physically shaped like a villain,
is that,
let's talk about the Elastic Monster.
You can't just say, speaking of...
a perfect segue.
Hey, should we give, before we segue, should we give Brad Bird a shout out as a person who we just have not really spoken about?
Oh yeah, about? Brad Bird, that's like his thing, right? He does stuff like that.
Well, he's nice. Brad Bird was, at the time this movie came out, you know, he had done The Incredibles and more specific to our show, Iron Giant. So these were, you know, these were movies that made an impact greater than the average movie does in this space.
Definitely.
So as a director of these, I feel like three is pretty good, puts you on the map. And Brad Bird was one of the first animated directors that I really started paying attention to, probably because of his fucking track record, because all of these movies were the kind of movies that people said, okay, hold on. I know animation, we always say it's great. Every animated movie that comes out, we go, oh yeah, it's really, really good.
It's for adults too.
But these are particularly amazing for what they're doing. And so I started paying a little attention to Brad Bird. And that ruins your segue to...
Hitoshi Matsumoto, the director of Big Man Japan.
Well done.
So we already covered R100, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. And now we're going to cover one of Hitoshi's other films, Big Man Japan, which happens to be one of my favorite films of all time. Eric, did you know that Hitoshi Masumoto has directed a number of films, but is also a very, very popular comedian in Japan?
No way, really?
It's very true. He's one of the most famous like TV comedian. He's like the Howie Mandel of Japan.
Howie Mandel, what? Yeah, okay.
He's Tom Bergeron, but Japanese.
He does in the dubbed version, he does Gizmo's voice. Yeah. That's what you're telling
right.
me.
Right, but yeah. in the Japanese version, he is actually the main character of this movie.
Man, no Patton Oswalt love on this show either. I feel like we're just missing everything.
I know, unfortunately. There's a lot to say about Ratatouille here in the Big Man Japan segment of today's show. But yeah, you also knew that he's the main character, right? Like that's less of a secret.
No, I didn't.
That's the director. So Hitoshi Matsumoto also plays...
I should know that. We follow him around the whole movie. It seems like...
Plays Big Man 6.
Yeah.
So when I was watching this movie... Again, I'd seen it a while ago, but I was dumb then and I'm smarter now.
Was this before or after you knew about Man Bites Dog?
Before.
Okay.
Definitely before. This was a long time ago. I definitely watched this like probably shortly after it came out and probably half paying attention.
Yeah.
And so to rewatch this, there's so much of this movie that I think is amazing, but one of my favorite things about this director, this movie, and kind of to just spring off of where the conversation began with Ratatouille is you have a premise here that is so rich. I mean, we're talking fucking 6 seasons of TV rich. Mm. We're talking if this guy could kill monsters with one punch, it'd be a cultural phenomenon.
Uh-huh.
And the movie goes, so it's like about this guy who gets big and then like defends Japan from these monsters. And I go, cool, I'm here. And they go, but it's actually about the emotional toll it takes from being a hereditary big man Japan in the dynasty of big man Japan.
Yeah.
And the pressures that goes along with being the generation after the most famous big man in the dynasty. And also, you know, what kind of toll that takes on you as a human being moving into the 21st century with things like advertising and sort of the ubiquity of people watching you and not giving a shit and just, you know, boredom culture.
Well, in so many of these industries that went from being rock star, I mean, fucking rock stars included in this analogy, but what a rock star used to mean versus means now.
Right.
What a film director used to mean versus means now. What right. really anybody in the spotlight, you... On television.
Sure.
What being on television used to mean versus means now.
Mm-hmm.
And how so many of these industries that were, you know, people still think about this guy as some presence, some huge, you know, what we're watching is basically an expose about him.
Mm-hmm.
And it wouldn't be an expose if it wasn't telling us things we didn't know. So his standing in life is surprising to the people who aren't paying attention to him.
Right.
Everybody goes, oh yeah, he's a big man. So that should just, we know what his life is like. It must be grand or whatever. I don't really pay attention, but I'm sure he's fine.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're kind of watching it to see actually there's a lot of suffering and it wasn't the way it used to be.
Right.
It's kind of a nice allegory to really so many other things like
yeah,
this.
It's like American Idol season 12 versus American Idol season 2.
I mean, when you say that, think about if you followed an American Idol star today.
I know. No, I know.
It really does apply, I think.
Or imagine if somebody told you that, well, it's again to go back to that fucking reboot culture. But, you know, 10 years ago, if somebody told you a Godzilla movie or a Gamera movie was coming out, you'd just be like, ugh. You know? Because it was when people just went, I don't know, people will show up to this shit. Let's just do a fucking Roland Emmerich version.
Well, it's interesting too, because under the guise of a movie as an expose or a movie as a faux documentary, these are always used to such different ends. I mean, the medium of, I feel like not too long ago we were talking about What We Do in the Shadows, or I don't really know if this is the right place for, well, maybe we do need like a little quick Man Bites Dog primer, but I just find it interesting how all of these movies that one might follow in another's footsteps, they all serve such different purposes.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just, oh, we're doing this movie. Think about any other kind of subgenre that we talk about. A lot of times when you tap into the subgenre, you do it for the same purpose over and over with maybe a little bit different of a kind of hook to it. But the expose movie can be used for so many purposes, just dramatically differently. Before we had something, so Man Bites Dog, I think, was the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And it was it's this Belgian film that follows around a killer, and it does it as a documentary. And something, you know, I guess the easiest way to say it is that movies that attempted to do that thing before Man Bites Dog looked a little more like Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer.
That's the first thing that came to mind, yeah.
Now, that's a narrative film. It looks like a movie in most respects. There's other interesting things about it, but it doesn't look like a documentary crew. And after Man Bites Dog, we could have things like Behind the Mask.
The Office.
Well, or What We Do in the Shadows, yeah. Or all of these other, not to pin it specifically to that movie, but it did open up the idea, especially in horror. Everything else really gets attributed back to Man Bites Dog, but I feel like Big Man Japan actually honors it in the sort of talking about deeper issues.
Mm-hmm.
It's not commenting, I don't think, so much on genre. Well, maybe it is. I don't know. Let me pose that question to you. Do you think this is a criticism of kaiju films?
I would say that this is a criticism of the audience of kaiju films, but not kaiju films themselves. I mean, a little.
How do you make that distinction?
Well, I don't know. I think it's kind of just a general lampoon of the whole thing. But the audience is disinterested. This guy's still doing his thing. The monsters are lame that he's fighting. We get it. They have like fucking lame comb overs or something. and people just generally don't like him. He's dropping babies left and right. And so I think to that effect, especially with the ending, I think the ending is where it points the lens, so to speak, back at the audience and goes, this is your fault. Because, you know, it's basically going, kaiju movies used to be popular and now we have to stick fucking advertising in them in order to make them even like something that we can make money from. It's like the only thing that people want to watch now is fucking Ultraman.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have a little bit of that life in the spotlight thing and that's there. And I feel like we've addressed that, but I guess I'm interested a lot in the kaiju part of it.
Sure.
Because I don't know as much about that. And so when I watch it, I have a little trouble articulating it, but I guess my question is basically, you know, if I were a hardcore fan of today's kaiju, would I watch this movie and feel like it's mocking me in a way?
Today's kaiju or 2003's kaiju? Because today's kaiju is fucking, you know, Gareth Edwards, Godzilla, and Skull Island. You know, it's this, it's this supersized resurgence of kaiju that basically tries to, you know, modernize the original vibe or the 80s vibe even.
Sure, sure. Well, we know that it's pointing inward.
But are we talking like Toho 2000?
I mean, I guess that's where I was curious about your distinction between the audience and the genre, because I sort of feel like, if anything, it's pointing at what the genre's become.
Sure.
Although I guess that indicts the audience too. So I don't know. Maybe you're right. Maybe the distinction there isn't that important. The part that sticks with me is watching this movie, getting so much of that Man Bites Dog thing, getting the spotlight part of it, moving through the movie, nodding along, going, this is hip. I understand what's going on here. You know, I'm dialed into this movie. I'm getting it right at the level that it's talking to me. And then this fucking ending happens. And all of a sudden I go, whoa, that movie just ran over my head very quickly. And so, and you know, I really dig the ending of this movie, but there's a what the fuck factor that, and probably why I like it, that I just suddenly go, okay, this got a whole level deeper. And of course, that's the uncomfortable area for me. So I want to stick there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's mm-hmm. the place that I want to kind of play around and figure out what the fuck is happening. I feel like the other thing that's wild about it is once the movie hits credits, there is a whole...
There's still like another 10 minutes of movie?
Well, that I think is very valuable.
Yeah, for sure.
Right? I don't think that's a sort of laugh it off Jackie Chan blooper reel.
Right.
That no, is in...
It's not the, shawarma. It's not a shawarma this is moment. Actually,
yeah, this is the scene that may be more important than the one right before it mm-hmm. in understanding what the fuck happened. It is... this group sitting around the table basically talking openly in a way that they weren't in the scene prior. In the scene prior, nobody wants to address anything and it's fucking weird, especially when they're flying off with him. They just won't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going, what is this alien mm-hmm. race of Ultramen about? And how do they fit into, I mean, more importantly, even if you understand the kind of reference and what's being tied in there, how do they fit into this world that we've built? How do they fit into the reality the movie's operating in? And so the scene after that expands on that. It's a, you know, within these walls conversation, the public is not listening. Let's address the show we put on. And so talking about that as a show, which is a way that the big man does not seem to really think about the sort of showbiz element
right.
of this.
Right.
He goes out and beats up the monsters, but he almost has this lack of public scrutiny or public perception, I guess. You know, he drops the baby and kind of goes, what's the big deal? Why mm-hmm. don't you guys leave me alone about this? Whereas the team at the end is very concerned with even the smallest amounts of, look, don't take a half step. Take the step or don't take the step.
Mm-hmm.
Don't bend over this way. Like, don't hit it with a bus first. Hit it with your fist first. It's a better thing for a hero to do. And these are the in-house conversations about, look, you really got to pay attention. That's almost the only thing they're worried about. You really have to pay attention to how we're portrayed to the people out there. Like, what kind of image we're making for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess that's what that scene is, but it still feels like it's sudden. Do you feel that way? Do you feel like this movie suddenly addresses a brand new thing or adds another layer in the last 20 minutes of the movie?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it. I think there's a lot of things that happen quickly and I scramble for answers until I'm finally comfortably sitting around a dinner table.
Yeah, until you're on Double Feature where we are the first, we are the big man.
We do not
think about, oh no, are we going to look stupid to everybody who's seen this movie and knows what they're talking about? We're like, nobody's watching. What's up with the end of this big man movie? What are they doing?
Well, at first my thought was, oh, he fails. And then they just like made a production about him not failing. That was what I initially thought. And then his character is confused. And I go, nope. He doesn't understand what's going on either, but he's definitely still there.
Yeah.
And so I think it's more of like a commentary on like, this is why you're failing. You know, you're trying to be a normal person and nobody's here to see a normal person fight these monsters.
Yeah.
Like, please stop beating them by appealing to their sensibilities when they're stinking up the highway. Like, don't right. sit and have a conversation, hit them with a bus.
Right. Yeah. Well, I do think it's interesting too, that it gives us some additional information with which to view the rest of the movie. Having a contrast like that at the end doesn't just feel like we're talking about a new thing, but look, we've already kind of discussed it here. Like, it says, it critiques his performance in a way.
Mm-hmm.
It gives us an additional, we've been watching this whole movie as a documentary, as an audience, and now we have even an additional perspective a totally different point of view with which to judge everything that's happened. Super cool thing for the movie to do. Super cool reason you should have watched the movie. Why haven't you watched Big Man Japan? All right. The website's doublefeature.fm. Email address is doublefeatureshow@icloud.com. Email us and let us know you just signed up for the patreon.com/doublefeature.
Doesn't the Patreon do that for us?
I don't think so, because if it did, I would sob every time someone left, and it seems to just hide the notification from me.
I doubt it. It's definitely not the kind of thing where it sends an email when people leave. No platform on earth tells you when somebody stops following you.
I want to especially thank Patrick Klein, Donald Muzzy, Deshelle Shapiro, Marcus Williams, and Tony Gleed this episode. They're not the executive producers. Those are some showrunners and people slipping us the dark money, keeping the show going. But of course, a huge thanks to our executive producers as well. Just wanted to hit up all the people, mm-hmm. You know?
Sure.
You know what else I want to hit up is that Bob's Big Boy. Do you have Bob's Big Boy down there?
No, you guys don't have
that, do you?
Definitely not.
That was so wild seeing that in
Japan.
Really, really weird seeing it in Big Man Japan. Well, because Bob's Big Boy is, you know, in LA, if you go to a Bob's Big Boy, it's an Americana 50s diner.
Uh-huh.
And in Japan, it looks like a Japanese restaurant. Very fucking weird and also super funny. Seems like a no-brainer if your movie is called Big Man Japan to put a Bob's Big Boy in it. So
sure, that is funny.
Easy win, and you took it. You took that money on the table. John, Aaron Shore, Billy Wilson, Bruno Hunziker, Brad Hayton, Tom Leonard, Abbott of Unreason, Charles Crawford, and Ben Acker. What are we doing next time on the show?
What are we doing ever on the show? But next time, we are going to do
appeasing the hungry Patreons.
Yeah, that's true. Our Patreon overlords. Next time on the show, we're going to do... This is interesting because the pair next week, one of these movies is a movie that you've been trying to get on the show for fucking ever. And I'm really excited next week to find out why the fuck that is. I don't want to know right now.
Uh-huh. All right. And I don't know which of those movies it is either. So that's
a film called Eden Lake.
Oh, good. All right.
And then we're pairing that with, one of those movies that is like Stepford Wives, Why Haven't You Watched This Fucking Good?
Uh-huh.
Which is the 1973 Wicker Man with Dracula.
Not the Bees.
No, not the Bees. The other one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Probably won't be any.
So punch your grandma bears, watch more fucking film.
It's what I wanted. Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.